Hi, my name is Sarah Tulloch, Talking Writing's podcast production manager, and this is the Talking Writing podcast. Please enjoy the episode and subscribe to our paid Substack for bonus episodes.
Welcome, Mina. I'm so glad to have you here in the Talking Writing podcast.
How Nova, thank you for having me.
Right. And let's get to it. Your book, Owning Our Struggles, A Path to Healing and Finding Community in a Broken World. Before we discuss, well, congratulations, first of all, for your debut. This is your debut book, right?
Yes, it is. Thank you. Yes.
And most of our listeners are authors and aspiring authors as well. So I think it would be good to start with a genesis of how your book came about. Did this start off as a book concept, or did this start off as a smaller series of articles or essays? Walk us through your book journey.
Yeah, so it definitely did start off as a book concept. And to share a little more about the concept of my book. So the title is Owning Our Struggles, A Path to Healing and Finding Community in a Broken World. My background is I'm a licensed social worker, and I practice as a therapist for 9 years before pivoting to corporate wellness. So now I run a mental health consulting practice where I work with organizations to help them develop psychological safety. So I say all of that to say my background is in educating through mental health. So I wrote, my book is nonfiction. And when it came to the topic, the core premise of the book is healing from trauma through community care. So when the concept for the book came to mind, I knew that it was going to be something that was a little meatier than the content that I normally put out, for example, on social media, or even the articles that I write about when it comes to mental health. I knew when it came to community care, I wanted to pretty much get to the bones of that work. So that is why I knew from day one, when I started to draft the concept for my book, I knew that it would have to be in long form.
Yeah, that's a really important insight. Because, you know, every now and then, I'm sure people will toy about like leaving a legacy through writing a book. But there's so much more that goes into writing a book. It's knowing whether you have enough material for a book, or if the concept or the, as you said, the subject that you have, you're thinking about, is enough to engage people through pages and chapters of the book. And in your case, in your book, Owning Our Struggles, it really is a lot. And I felt like reading the book that there could be more. So I'm sure that this is not going to be your last book either. But it does feel like a work that needed to come out. A book that was really meant to be in book form. And I appreciated it so much because, you know, in a sea of self-help books, even from experts, even from qualified licensed mental health practitioners, there's a lot of emphasis on oversimplification with very little nuance. I guess because, you know, writing a book, you also need to engage the reader. And so maybe through that thinking, like concepts about mental health or the subject of mental health tends to be a bit oversimplified, and emphasis is placed mostly on hacks. But your book is more about the building blocks of healing. It really doesn't skip that. In fact, it's like a very meaty part of your book. And I couldn't help but notice that, there are 7 parts, I think. And are these loosely based on like the hierarchy of need? When you were thinking about the structure of your book, how did you imagine it in the beginning, and how did you decide on the final structure of your book?
So when I started to really conceptualize the chapters of the book, I was specifically thinking about my clients. So to add context, as I shared earlier, I did practice as a therapist. And so in my book, I weave in client stories, but I also share stories from my own journey and my childhood. And so I really started to reflect on the different experiences I had as a therapist and the core needs my clients had. And that is what actually helped me create the roadmap for the book. And so, for example, chapter one starts on childhood, chapter two brings us into adulthood. Chapter three focuses on race, and chapter four now brings us into dealing with family. Chapter five focuses on relationships. Chapter six focuses on work. And then chapter seven pretty much is like a roundup of all of the things that we learned in chapters one through six. And so I think it felt relatable to the readers because as I was reflecting on the needs of my clients, I figured, well, everybody has a need when it comes to unpacking their childhood. Everyone has a need when it comes to building healthy relationships, whether it's platonic or not. You know, when I wrote the book, when I wrote the concept of the book, it was 2020. And so that was around a time where our relationship to work was shifting. A lot of people were working from home. A lot of people who were underpaid and overworked were starting to quit. A lot of people started to see a disruption in how they showed up in the workforce. So I think because of the times that were happening, which was, like I said, 2020, while also reflecting on the needs of my clients, that played a big role in the roadmap for my book. And I will say that as I started to flesh the book out, the roadmap didn't really change much. So when I started the book, I knew like these are the core things I want the chapters to focus on. And by the end of the book, those chapters actually remained the same.
That's amazing. It just speaks to, I guess, your experience and your expertise, because you really narrowed down like what you were able to express and to write, the needs of your client and how that's relatable to, these are the missing steps that I feel like are missing in many of the personal development and self-help books when it comes to mental health. You said a very A particular thing that really resonated with me about how healing is a social justice issue because, trauma impacts not just the one who is suffering from it, but the family unit, the communities and society as a whole. But the attitude towards healing in the public facing, arena is more about individual healing. You have to own it by yourself. You have to do it by yourself. Do you have to go to therapy? It's a you problem and not a community problem, right? So why do you think the concept of healing and self-care became toxic, became this toxic individualistic endeavor? How do you think that came about?
That's a good question. I really wish I could pinpoint where I think it came from. But I will say that I do think the rise of social media has played a role in that. Now we have these devices and we have these apps that we have access to 24/7. So when you're suffering or when you're hurt or angry, you now have an outlet where you can pretty much displace that anger. And I think that by having that outlet, it kind of also created for some people a sense of learned helplessness because not only do you have this app where you can displace your rage and frustration, you also have these apps now that's exposing you to multiple forms of trauma. Trauma has always existed across the globe, but due to the fact that we have apps and social media, due to overconsumption, we are chronically being exposed to trauma. Where if we didn't have these apps, these traumas would be existing and the atrocities would be existing. But back in the day, when you think of boomers, you read about it through the paper, or if you had cable, if you could even afford a TV. Or before TVs, we had radio, right? So you had access to information, but it was very, very limited and it wasn't 24 hours a day. So I think that the more we are being exposed to atrocities and the more we have these devices and these apps that allow us to express ourselves. I think a lot of people are being so exposed to just pain, whether it be pain happening on a societal level or the pain of the person who decided that they wanted to just log on to Instagram and show themselves crying or just show a very vulnerable part of themselves. And I think it's causing some people to want to retreat from that and creating this illusion that healing kind of has to happen in online spaces when true healing really is happening in person and it's happening in community. But I think the more we get information online on how to be in community with people, how to manage trauma, or just thinking about the mental health space that exists online, I think that's also impacting how people show up in their everyday relationships.
Yeah, that's true. There's a huge, a huge demand or pressure for performativity, right? And so, like, the virtual spaces are becoming more and more indistinguishable from the real life spaces. And in your book, you make a point of really saying that, okay, you're doing this personal, very personal inner work on yourself, but it needs to come out. It needs to sort of manifest in your relationships too, and how you connect with people in the friendships that you make and your relationships as well. And I feel like, reading your book, I felt it was difficult in the sense that I was forced to, there's a lot of emphasis on making an experience seamless, frictionless. But when it comes to dealing with trauma and all of that, it's not a seamless process. It's sometimes you start and you stop and then you go back again. And I sense that realness while reading your book. It's not saying that, oh, let me make you comfortable. Like, this is a comfortable process. It really leads me as a reader into really examining even the difficult things. And so I wanted to ask, like, 'cause was it a very intentional, or was there pushback when you chose the title Owning Your Struggles? Because that was my first, like, visceral reaction to the book, like, using the word struggles. Usually, they wouldn't want that word on a title, right? Because it's like, people don't want things that are hard, right? So when you conceptualize the title, was there pushback at all?
Shockingly, no. The title was embraced from the very beginning. The subtitle is what changed. And it wasn't necessarily that there was pushback on the first title. I think my publishers felt like there was a lack of clarity from the subtitle. So, Owning Our Struggles from day one was a core fit for the publisher. And I was really excited about that because I titled the book myself. And so, it was really important to me for the title to remain the same. But as the book evolved, I did understand where my publisher felt that the subtitle could be a little different to give the reader a bit more clarity. And I think to bring in some levity, because as you just shared, like struggles can be difficult. But when you provide more context by saying that this is going to be a path to healing and finding community, especially in a broken world, and it was being released in 2023. So this is the aftermath of the pandemic. I think a lot of people were looking for relief around
Yeah.
the brokenness that they were being exposed to.
Like the
So
what's next,
luckily,
right?
yes, right. They wanted the what's next. So luckily, owning our struggles remained the same. But I am happy that the subtitle evolved to what it is now.
And I think that the word struggle also is a really good word, a really good title for what the book is about, because It just says like if you're living, the price of living is you're gonna struggle, whether physically, mentally, emotionally. And it works really well in the structure of the book, like the struggle for wholeness, struggle for healing, safe space. You said I also read that there are like case studies that you cited for some of the chapters here, right? Did the order of the way you structured your book, was this also reflective of of the stages of your therapy, of how you became a therapist? Like, did you start by primarily dealing with healing childhood trauma with your parents, and then did you progress from that?
Yes, so absolutely. That is actually how the roadmap manifested. In my own personal journey, not just professionally by being a therapist, I also have engaged in therapy. And I believe you all need to in order to effectively do this work. And so I do know that during my earliest experiences in therapy, I spent a lot of time unpacking my childhood. And when working with clients, I'm spending a lot of time with them unpacking their childhood. So immediately I knew that when I was setting the roadmap for the book, the first thing I wanted to dive into is childhood trauma and giving people tools to reflect on their childhood, mostly because it's very common for adults to feel like I'm not a kid anymore. So why are we talking about that? Or those things don't matter anymore because it happened 20, 30 or even 40 plus years ago, so I don't need to address it. And that's actually not always true. Sometimes, as an adult, you can still be dealing with the impact from the things you dealt with as a child. So it was really important for me to just start there so that the people who tend to run away from their childhood could really sit with the things that are happening in their childhood. Now, I also think that because of the structure of the book, you could pretty much start wherever you want to start in the book. It's not something that I personally think reads in a linear way. But I do think that just starting there helps people to figure out now when I read chapter two, I can reflect more because I just read chapter one and I learned so much about myself through chapter one, that I can read the rest of the book with different eyes and a different perspective.
Exactly. And I see the chapter one really reflected, or you go back on some of the concepts from chapter one in the rest of the parts of the book. And I think that one big difference also that made me really enjoy reading your book is that it's really made with a lot of the things that were excluded when mental health conversations on mental health and healing were talked about, specifically like experiences of people of color, the cultural differences, like acknowledging that there are cultural differences which are not necessarily right or wrong. And as someone who just I am now in therapy, but for the first time, and because growing up culturally, therapy wasn't a thing. Your healing and your mental health depended on how the community supported you. There's always like, community support, family support. And you mentioned this as well in your own in the book with your parents, with your pet, and it's not your mother and father. Like culturally, they find their healing elsewhere, but also because it's rooted in the historical trauma that and distrust with the medical industry, right? And so my question is for those who are struggling with they're not open to going to therapy, or it's not accessible for them, how do you gauge whether you have enough community support for you to heal? Like, how do you know that reading your book and having family support or personal support is enough? And is enough as a kind of intervention? Like, what would your advice be?
I think it's dependent on the issues that you are going through and how people are showing up for you. A common thing that I find happens is that people will find themselves suffering and they will say things like, well, I can just talk to my friends and my family. But the problem is that despite all the talking that they're doing, they're not necessarily finding reprieve from their situation and they're not finding a solution. So they find themselves on the hamster wheel of complaining, and focusing more so on their problems, but they're not solution oriented. And it's probably because the people in their lives don't know how to work with them. So they're listening, or they are giving advice and the advice really isn't fruitful. So therefore that person find themselves kind of like in this cycle where it's like, okay, I do have people to talk to, but I've been talking to my friends or my partner about this issue for 5 years now, and I'm still struggling. And that could be a sign that, well, the people you're talking to are not necessarily providing you with the care and the support that you need, because maybe you need to work with a professional. You know, it's literally the equivalent of sometimes when we are home and we catch a cold. You know, I speak about in my book, my own cultural background, I'm Panamanian and Colombian. And so sometimes when I get sick, my mom will make me ginger tea, or she'll make me a chicken noodle soup. You know, she'll use a lot of remedies that we use back home. And I'm okay with that. Like, you know, if I have a cold, I'm like, all right, mom, yeah, the ginger tea is perfect. Right. But if I, for example, have an illness and I may need surgery, the ginger tea is not going to cut it, right? And so that is when I have to realize, yes, I have my mom who can provide me with these holistic resources that she used and that I even use sometimes when I'm sick. But right now I am so ill that I need medical and professional care. And that's how I kind of look at it when it comes to our own mental and emotional state, where sometimes you have the people in your life who are bringing you the ginger tea, but you might realize, actually, I need to go to the emergency room because the ginger tea is not going to cure this issue, right? And how can I do both, right? How can I drink the ginger tea and take the prescription that my doctor gave me? Maybe I need an IV and that's why I need to go to the ER. But if you want to bring me ginger tea too, I'll drink that as well, right? And so you can incorporate both in your life, but I think that is a sign that you probably need deeper care when you realize the support people are giving you really isn't moving the needle.
It's not supposed to be an all or nothing proposition, right? And I think in your book you also mentioned that, like, when you're complaining but not solving the issue, you know, that's, as you said, it's a hamster wheel that's not healthy after a while, and you risk burdening the people around you because it's the same issues over and over. It kind of becomes an issue in itself. Just, you know, over confiding to people. But yeah, like we mentioned, like specific cultural differences affect our attitudes towards healing and mental health. But the principles in your book are pretty universal. You know, even if you have different cultural background, or you're reading this from Singapore or Hong Kong, these things still apply. You can relate to it. However, I also really appreciated when you talked about the American dream. Like, there was one exercise in your book towards the end where you asked to define the American dream, because it's so incorporated in our definition of success, like especially for people of color and immigrants. But my question is, do you think, like, this myth, because it's no longer what it used to mean, right? It's becoming more and more of a myth. Like, what is your view on this? Do you think the American dream needs to leave our lexicon or our mindset at some point?
You know, writing that chapter brought up a lot for me. because I had to process a lot of what you're asking me. And I think overall, we need to demolish a lot of systems at play. I think that because the American dream is the belief that all people should have freedom, and we should all be able to achieve economic prosperity and upward mobility, I think those things are necessary for survival. But the reality is, all opportunities are not equal. And so, therefore, achieving economic prosperity and upward mobility looks very different for people who are lower class compared to people who are higher class. It looks completely different for people who are white compared to people who are marginalized in communities of color. And so, is there anything wrong with wanting to achieve economic prosperity and upward mobility and freedom? No. But if that is the goal, then that means everyone should have an opportunity to experience those things. And we need to pay attention to the barriers that exist on an interpersonal level, as well as on a systemic level, that interferes with people being able to grow in society and achieve what we're calling the American dream, living behind the white picket fence and being able to own a home. The current climate that we're living in, people see that achieving the American dream is not really achievable, right? Just looking at the housing market, and we've been told that that is a big part of obtaining wealth in our country, right? But obtaining wealth is not equal opportunity. Right? It's supposed to be, but the reality is there are a lot of barriers at play that oppresses a lot of people and makes it harder for them to achieve these opportunities. And so I think that we can aspire for the American dream, but I do think we need to be realistic about what it takes to achieve it. And I think we need to be realistic about the barriers in place, and that the American dream really has not always been for every person and every identity in this country. And so when it comes to healing, we also have to remember that healing is a social justice issue, which is what I write in the book. And if we want to thrive, we should also want our communities to thrive. And when our communities thrive, then in exchange, our society will thrive.
I know you talk a bit about this in your book, but what is your take on how we can bring much needed healing interventions in a community setting? Specifically, the role of art, the role that art and writing or, visual art, craft making, how do you think this can be brought to a community level? Or why does it need to be brought in a community level?
Well, I think that community care is essential, not just on an interpersonal level, but on a social level. And I think it's important for us to pay attention to our social infrastructure and examine the things that are available to us in our communities that promotes holistic practices that helps us to care for our well-being. And so small things like, is there greenery? Are there parks in my neighborhood? Things like, are there recreational centers in my neighborhood? What are children doing nowadays aside from being on their iPhones, right? Are there things for people to do and things in their community that helps them thrive? Are there community care centers where there are clinics where they can get access to free and accessible mental health and therapy? Are there urgent cares available? How many hospitals exist within a zip code? So I think it's really important for us to pay attention to that social infrastructure and its role in our well-being, because we're not disconnected from our environment. If my environment is suffering, I am also going to suffer because I exist in that environment. And our environment isn't just our family system, it's also what's happening outside of the family system. Do I have access to quality education? Are the public schools in my zip code, is it just achievable? Is it something that is really going to provide my child with quality education, little things like that, you know, and they're not so little, but they feel little sometimes. But these are things that tend to be overlooked. And so when we think about our basic needs, needing food, shelter, safety, belonging, that also is required in our environment as well. And so I think that when we focus on that, we can see a shift in the development of our mental health and well-being.
And that's like a bigger undertaking. It can feel overwhelming if we think about it on an individual level, right? But even in on an individual level, I come from a country, the Philippines, where you just can't expect like a higher level source of support. And so all of the interventions tend to be private, community workarounds that because it's just so urgent. And so like I come back to the issue of one of the things that really is actively working for our community sometimes are the art and the writing community efforts as a way of expression, as a way of feeling that you're not alone because you're doing it together at the same time. And it's interesting to me that you chose to write a book, like the act of writing itself. Like, do you think that art making and writing could be not a substitute for therapy, of course, but how could or why are these modes of expression so vital as well to healing, to community healing and togetherness?
Yeah, well, so I don't think that it is a replacement for therapy, but art and creativity is always going to be therapeutic. Those are practices that many therapists even incorporate into their practice as a coping mechanism, from journaling to art therapy to dance and movement. There are so many trained professionals who actually incorporate those things into their healing modalities because it provides a holistic framework. And so I think the more we can focus on holistic healing, the more we will be able to see an increase in our mental health and well-being, and understanding that, yes, caring for ourselves requires us to tune into our emotions and just be very mindful of the things that we're experiencing or our past, and just understanding and recognizing the traumas that we go through or the stress that we experience. But the healing practice, that is something we also have to pay attention to as well, and realize that talk therapy is essential for healing. But when we're talking about our problems, we also want to be doing. We want to be proactive. And being proactive could look like, I'm going to write, or I'm going to draw, or I'm going to go to a dance class, or I'm going to the gym. And that holistic healing can also be really, really vital in just increasing our well-being.
I have to say that now that I've started therapy, talk therapy, I didn't know just how much of an impact it can really have and how many things are buried that need to come out to really facilitate healing. There are certain things that happen over and over and I thought that it was just how things were, but then through talk therapy, you discovered that it's a pattern that you put yourself through, and you can take charge in your own way to break out of that pattern that's not serving you. So I totally agree with what you're saying that art is not is a mode of expression, but it's not like a substitute for healing. It can just be probably an added, a supplementary thing to help with self-introspection, maybe, or self-awareness. But I'm curious to know, like, for you, how did you come about? How did you discover writing? Like, when did you, develop a love for writing?
That started at a really young age for me because I always loved reading. My love for reading dates back to elementary school, and I used to read fiction as a form of healthy escapism. And I just always loved character development, and I just loved everything about the fiction world, you know? And so because I loved reading so much, it actually inspired me to want to write, to see if I could create that sense of escapism myself without relying on another author. So I just always, and I've written different mediums. I've written poetry before, I've written fiction before. So even though this is my debut book and it's nonfiction, I've been, I guess you can call it a practicing writer, for many, many years of my life. So I will definitely say that my love for writing is very much paired with my love for reading.
Yeah. And so I will ask you the signature question of talking writing, which is like, what do you think is the use of writing? Because it's not a very utilitarian thing, right? It's not the benefits are not so evident. But writers keep on writing, you know, whether they get any external validation or not, like you said, like even though this is your debut book, you've been writing forever. Right. So what do you think is the use of writing? Why do you write?
I think it's about telling a story out loud. I think it's about recognizing that words have power. You know, we were told as children, sticks and stones can break our bones, but words can't hurt us. That's actually not true. Words can hurt, but I do think words can also inspire. Words can also create a nurturing, loving, caring environment. When we hear words, we are moved. But I also think when we read words, we are moved. And sometimes the person that is being moved is you, because there are many times where I've written things, and when I would read it back to myself, I'm like, wow, that changed me. And I'm the one who produced it. But there's a different version of me that comes to life when I'm reading my work versus being in the process of writing out my work. And so I just truly believe that if you know that there are stories that need to be told, tell them. And I personally don't think that the aim should always be the masses has to hear our story. Sometimes the story is for you. Sometimes the story is for a friend, a family member, or just the people in your small community. And see if that story grows. And if it doesn't, keep writing new stories.
That's beautiful, right? Like it doesn't have to be for public consumption. It's enough that you're telling a story, right? And on that note, I highly recommend everyone to buy, borrow, just read Owning Our Struggles, A Path to Healing and Finding Community in a Broken World. It's not just prescriptive, as you said many times during our interview. You also shared your own story as well as the stories of the other folks that you've worked with. And yeah, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. Is there anything else? Where can our listeners find you?
Well, you can connect with me on social media. My handles are Mina underscore B. Mina is spelled MINAA underscore B. You can also visit my website and sign up for my newsletter, where I share a newsletter on how to build healthy relationships with ourselves and others. My newsletter is called Mindful with Mina, and my podcast is also an
Yes.
extension of my newsletter. So my podcast, Mindful with Mina, is also available on major platforms, wherever you listen to your podcast. And I talk about different ways that we can develop healthy relationships with ourselves as well as other people to live a full, expansive life.
I forgot to ask this in the beginning, but I'll ask it now. The spelling of Mina with a double A at the end, with two A's at the end, Is that significant? Like, what? It's not a usual spelling of Mina. Can you tell us more about it?
Honestly, no, it's not significant. The joke is that Mina B is actually my childhood nickname that my friends in middle school gave me. And the reason why there is a double A is because I remember when I wanted to create a username back when we had AOL, when we
Oh
had
my
dial-up
God.
internet, and I would run home and I wanted to get on AOL chat and talk to my friends. Mina with one A was taken. And so I added the second A, and it's been that since middle school, since sixth grade. I've been using the double A's because people always take the Mina with one A.
That's you owning Mina, right?
That's me
The
owning Mina.
They're not giving you Mina with a one A, so you're gonna own Mina with two A's.
Exactly. And it's just stuck since.
Yeah, thank you for answering that. And thank you for joining us, Mina. This has been really informative.
Thank you for having me, Neva.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.